a Church of England disciplinary tribunal for Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal, to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person, and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I. And so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. It can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form, and needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying, we agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him, and the Palestinian cause. Saeed Poor is up, London.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out of control energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States House of Representatives has announced an investigation into allegations of a secret deal to boost oil production between the administration of President Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia. Biden is accused of trying to arrange a deal with Riyadh to increase oil production ahead of the U.S. midterm elections last month. Conservative lawmakers say that could represent election manipulation. It's the first official probe announced since the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives. Many other controversial hearings are expected to follow, such as on the handling of the coronavirus, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, corruption allegations involving Biden's son, and others. Just as Democrats forced questionable investigations over the past 2 years, a now divided Congress will likely be preoccupied with partisan issues of often questionable importance to the average person.
In the end of neoliberalism, we're in a kind of age of disorder. And this is kind of the show that is being played out, is that people are just going to be disillusioned from politics entirely. And that's going to open up the potential of polarization, like wider polarization.
Pro-Trump representatives in the House have already introduced articles of impeachment against Biden over the family-related corruption allegations. Many are skeptical that Congress will devote enough time to meeting the widespread economic problems caused by record inflation and Western belligerence towards Russia, China, Iran, and others.
Now, let's still push through the agenda that's necessary to to maintain the super rich are super rich and that no relief for the working class. And once again, points to the need for the urgency for the foundation for a new party and also ultimately a new system.
An irony is that Riyadh and the OPEC Plus oil production group ultimately ignored Biden's demands for more oil and instead voted to cut production. And despite the cuts, last month Biden still awarded Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity for all cases involving the infamous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Biden campaigned on holding bin Salman accountable, and his backtracking drew global condemnation. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet. Essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana.
in the limelight.
After beating Spain to reach the quarterfinals of the World Cup, the Moroccan national team players raised the Palestinian flag to celebrate their victory. Footage on social media showed a number of Moroccan players raising the Palestinian flag alongside their own Moroccan one, taking a group photo with the Palestinian flag on the pitch following the end of the match. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, fans from around the world supporting their national teams, along with other soccer fans at the Qatar World Cup, have displayed their strong opposition toward the fake regime of Israel in another slap in the face for the occupying regime. The increasingly vast number of videos going viral on social media show a rising number of nationals from around the world supporting their own different international teams, have been avoiding, intruding, shouting, and even shoving Israeli journalists. Other videos showed loud disruptions of Israeli live broadcasts by football supporters from around the globe, chanting pro-Palestine slogans. In one of the latest such videos that have been doing the rounds on the internet, an England fan shocked an Israeli World Cup reporter in Qatar by shouting, "Free Palestine" during a live TV broadcast. The video shows the England supporter Harry Hatton being interviewed by the Israeli journalist after the English national team beat Senegal 3-0 when he screamed, "It's coming home," but more importantly, "Free Palestine." The phrase "It's coming home" is the reference to a song released when England was hosting its first major football tournament, the 1996 UEFA European Football Championship, since the national team won the 1966 World Cup. The Israeli reporter can be seen shaking his head and raising his hand in frustration as Hatton and his three friends, all of whom were wearing English football shirts, cheered in support. Following a wave of online support for Hatton, the England fan later wrote in a social media post, "I am glad I got to play my small part in highlighting this issue." Another sports reporter for the Zionist regime's Channel 13 said he has been shoved, insulted, and accosted by fans during his live reports from the tournament. "You are killing babies," fans yelled as they rammed into him during a broadcast. The Israeli journalist says he is now advising Israeli visitors to hide any of their Israeli identity so as not to provoke hostility. He also says that when a cell phone salesman noticed his friend's settings were written in Hebrew, the salesman exploded with anger, screaming at the Israeli to get out of Doha, let alone his cell phone store. "I was so excited to come in with an Israeli passport, thinking it was going to be something positive," the journalist said, adding, "It's sad, it's unpleasant. People were cursing and threatening us." Israeli journalists, who are the most visible symbols of their regime at the world's most popular tournament, have also been angrily scolded at or ignored by local residents, as well as fans from Arab and Islamic world. This has served as a reminder for the apartheid regime that despite signing the 2020 normalization deals with three Persian Gulf Arab kingdoms, ordinary citizens in those kingdoms and the wider region have deep animosity toward the Zionist regime and strongly oppose any relations with it. The Qatar World Cup has also highlighted the unity among Arab and Islamic visitors to Doha in their support for Palestine and anger toward the Zionist regime. This is something that regional conferences also focus on, but do not grab any attention from the global mainstream media. Fans supporting different teams are wearing armbands and other symbols of Palestine, waving flags in support of the Palestinian cause. They also have chanted songs in support of the Palestinians at multiple venues, with some stadiums seeing massive Palestinian flags on display at the stands. A man wearing a Tunisia shirt interrupted the game by running onto the field with a Palestinian flag. Another case involved Tunisian fans raising a huge Free Palestine flag during their game against Australia. Violence has erupted in the occupied West Bank this year, and just hours after news emerged that the number of Palestinians were shot dead in the West Bank, Arab fans at the World Cup in Qatar chanted in Arabic, "With a spirit and blood, we will redeem you, O Palestine." Before the World Cup began, FIFA announced that fans from Israelis, settlers squatting on occupied Palestinian territories, would be allowed to fly directly to Qatar for the World Cup from the occupied Palestinian territories for the first time. The indigenous Palestinians from the occupied Palestinian territories have also been allowed to travel to Doha by military occupation. Qatari officials have a history of public support toward the Palestinian cause and have insisted the temporary opening of its airways to Israelis was purely to comply with FIFA hosting requirements, not a step to any form of a move toward normalizing ties. The Qatari government says that Doha has informed Israeli officials that any escalation in Al-Quds, the besieged Gaza Strip, or the occupied West Bank during this time will risk the cancellations of the agreement, including the direct flights. If anything, the World Cup in Qatar has highlighted the failure of the so-called Abraham Accords, an agreement brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that normalized relations between the fabricated regime of Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. It comes amid protests across Bahrain against a visit by the Zionist regime president Isaac Herzog to the Persian Gulf Arab Kingdom for the first time. This is despite a heavy crackdown on protests in the kingdom, which protesters have defied, signaling the Bahraini citizens' strong opposition toward the ruler's decision to normalize Manama's ties with the Zionist regime. Earlier this year, a public opinion survey in the region found that the people of West Asia are overwhelmingly opposed to any form of normalization deal with the Zionist regime. The annual Arab Opinion Index, AOI, published by the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies, found that more than 85% of its 28,000 respondents opposed any diplomatic recognition of Israel. Just 6% of those polled said they would support such a move. Surveys in Sudan show almost 80% of the country's citizens who responded to polls said they also oppose any form of normalization. Any attempts to try to maintain some kind of illusion that the so-called Abraham Accords were anything other than a military and trade agreement between an apartheid entity and a few monarchies in the Persian Gulf is facing serious barriers. Nowhere has this been more evident than during the World Cup in Qatar, where the support for Palestine has been on full display and the disgust at the Israeli apartheid regime has hit international headlines. As witnessed in Doha, support for the Palestinian cause goes beyond West Asia region. It has stretched to the populations of people from around the world. The harassment of Israeli journalists at the World Cup by supporters of international teams is a drop in the ocean in comparison to the harassment of Palestinians by the Zionist regime. Palestinians who are living under a strict military occupation, The war crimes and genocidal campaigns, along with the mass murder of children, cannot be compared. Nevertheless, it has been a deeply embarrassing World Cup event for the Zionist regime and a PR campaign that has spectacularly backfired. The Palestinian flags waved at the World Cup and the chants in support of the Palestinian cause at the international tournament reflect the fact that Palestine has become a symbol of freedom among the free people in the world. On the other hand, over the past decade, footage showed that Israeli regime flags have been waved at white supremacist rallies in the United States and UK, among other Western states. This is while chants in support of the Zionist regime have been heard at extremist neo-Nazi rallies in Western Europe marching on the streets. Just think the irony. Also, the website of Palestinian Chronicle wrote the Moroccan national team, known as the Atlas Lions, made history when they won against Spain, one of the world's leading national football teams. Hakim Zakir and his squad played a mostly defensive game with a strategy that relied mainly on the counterattacks. With such international football stars Zakir, Ashraf Hakimi and Morocco's legendary goalkeeper Yassine Bounou, the Atlas Lions succeeded in reaching the end of the match without conceding any goals, considering that Spain had the most of the possession. It was in the penalty shootout that Moroccan players truly shined. Amid loud cheers and songs for Morocco and Palestine by tens of thousands of fans in Doha's Education City Stadium, the Moroccan team circled the field carrying the Palestinian and Moroccan flags. Like millions of Arabs, Palestinians tuned in to watch the Moroccan Lions make history. Palestinian journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle, Ramzi Barood, said in this regard, "Those who say that politics and sports do not mix know very little about the representation of football on the collective aspirations of people in the Middle East and around the world. To see Palestinians cheering for Morocco and Moroccans cheering for Palestine is one of the most significant Arab popular rejections of normalization with Israel," Barood added.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. has said that it is ready to use military power to maintain its international dominance, which it says is being challenged by China. Why does the U.S. feel that it is constantly being threatened by China? Why does the U.S. feel that in order to compete, it has to choose the military option? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is viewed as being of power in decline, how China may be replacing the U.S. in the near future. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us from Oslo.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, if I may, Ray McGovern. We're looking at the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin making these comments about China, of which he has said that, China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S., dominate international order. And then he issues a warning. Washington will not let that happen. And this is while the comments were made when the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider. What is the U.S. sending as a message there to China?
The message is that no one is going to dominate the world except the United States of America. That's our role. That's what we've been doing since World War II, and even more so since the end of the Cold War. Problem is that reality catches up with us. The problem is that the Chinese are going to surpass us economically, and they're working very hard to surpass us militarily. Not only that, more important still is the fact that China and Russia have the equivalents of a mutual alliance to include help should there be military action on either front. So let me just wind up by saying that at Valdai, at a speech, I think it was the 28th of October, and Mr. Putin said, you know, I don't understand. The U.S. is getting into a proxy war with Russia, and he's getting into trouble with China, too, of his own volition. He says, I don't want to misquote him. He said, you know, frankly, I don't know why the United States is doing this. Are they sane? It seems that this runs completely counter to common sense and logic. This is completely crazy. Now, the Russians and the Chinese don't have to be neurotic to worry about the United States. The U.S. strategic documents say, no, we're going to take Russia out first, and then we're going to work against China. Last thing I'll say is simply that the Chinese, you know, they have about four millennia of experience. They've never wanted to be the superpower of the world. They've got enough problems with their 1.4 billion people whom they've brought out of poverty. So the Chinese attitude, if I read it correctly, is Can't we just all get together and live together? Why do we have to have a win-lose situation? How about a win-win situation? Problem is, the United States and Joe Biden, in one of his very first speeches, says China is trying to become the dominant superpower. That's not going to happen on my watch. Well, I got news for Joe. It's happening, and it's going to happen even quicker with the Russia-Chinese virtual alliance.
Well, Ray McGovern makes a very good point there, Glenn Deason, about the fact that why does it have to be that route that the U.S. is taking? I mean, you're looking at how, you know, you have this B-21 stealth bomber being unveiled, and obviously the U.S. is sending a military message that it may use military power to maintain its international dominance. Why does the U.S. have to feel like that is the option to take when it comes to China, where China is not looking down that path, although we are saying more and more that it needs to at least show the U.S. the tools that it has?
Well, because after the Cold War, the United States, it put together a security strategy, a security document, very openly saying that its security was dependent on hegemony. So as long as the U.S. was dominant, hegemonic on a global scale, this would be the foundation for security. So any dispersal of power which reduces the dominance of the U.S. will be seen as a threat. Now, again, before you had U.S. and China, they were believed to be in this peaceful interdependence. The problem was it was never sustainable. It was supposed to be interdependence between, you know, the dominant and the weaker party. But you saw over time that China was producing and saving while the United States was consuming and borrowing. So as a result, China was accruing more and more industrial power, more and more advanced technology, and this ungodly amount of foreign reserves. Meanwhile, we saw the U.S. was losing a lot of productive power and sinking further into debt. So this was unsustainable in many ways. And at some point, this partnership had to collapse because the U.S. became worried about the growing strength of China, as it feared that China might dethrone the United States. Well, China became more worried that the United States would then turn to economic and military means to prevent its growth. And this is, at this point, you really needed an agreement where the two big countries could come together and say, listen, the new security system really has to be based on a multipolar format. We can't have this, maintain this unipolar moment of based on U.S. dominance when it's no longer reflected in reality. And again, the United States, it didn't show any interest in this, which is why China began to pursue, you know, technological sovereignty by decoupling from the United States, build its own transportation corridors with this Belt and Road initiatives, develop this financial architecture, new one decoupled from the U.S. with new payment systems and banks, sure, and new trading currencies. And the main reason was China was never offered an equal position, as we saw, for example, with the United States blocking Chinese efforts to get, for example, a greater role within the IMF. So because there was no willingness to convert from this unipolar system based on U.S. global hegemony to a multipolar system, it boils down to a military standoff where the United States is now attempting to build up an alliance system, an Asian NATO, if you will, to weaken China. Again, this would come after the United States is able, or if it's able, to break Russia.
Well, you mentioned the Belt and Road, and Ray McGovern, that is one of the shining track records for Xi Jinping that's still in development and is still a work in progress, of which, it's pretty much as it's been called a grand plan for the world economy. And the ones that subscribe to it along this road, the countries obviously are going to reap the benefits from it. At the same time, you've had the U.S. in the context of the Group of Seven leaders in the latest to say that they have raised $600 billion in private and public funds over 5 years to finance what they are calling, the U.S. president has called it, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. They made that claim back in June 2022. The year is almost over. I don't think that project is taken off, has it? I didn't see anything on that.
Well, I wish them luck with that. This is all counter to what they see the Chinese succeeding in doing. The Belt and Road Initiative is a major, major deal. And so many countries have become interested in taking part in one way or another. And other countries have sought membership in things like BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, S is for South Africa, group, and the Shanghai Cooperation Council. They're all turning away from what used to be the hegemon. Now, this is very serious because the sophomores, and I again call them sophomores, 2 years running since they flunked last year and had to repeat the year, the sophomores advising Joe Biden don't get it. They don't understand that the day is over when the U.S. calls the shots. And the Ukraine mess is just one example of that, where Russia was trying to protect its own core interests in Europe and enrolled China in supporting them, to the extent, mind you, that China violated its ground core, cornerstone principle of non-interference in the affairs of other countries, non-invasion of other countries, the whole Treaty of Westphalia, okay? What did they do? Well, in early February, when Mr. Putin went up to see Xi Jinping right before the Olympics, actually they launched the Olympics on the 4th of February, Putin said to Xi, and this I don't have in any report, but it's the logic that screams out. He said, Xi, the West is not taking us seriously. My people are being killed. The Russian stock people are being killed, up to 13,000 now in the Donbass. There are Nazis running the Ukrainian government. I think I may have to invade. What do you think? Now, my notion, judging from what ensued, is that Xi Jinping said, well, you mean after the Olympics are over, right? Putin smiled and said, oh, yeah. The day after the Olympics were over, Russia recognized the two provinces in the Donbass, Lugansk and Donetsk. 3 days later, the invasion. So it's very, very clear to me when the Chinese sort of condoned that and then offered an exclusion for Russia from the Westphalian principles, and then even this is important for students of Russia or China. You look at their language, and it went away from Westphalia, non-interference in the affairs of other countries, and it said, we Chinese judge core interests pursuing nations on their own merits. So they carved out an exception for China, for Russia. And why? Well, because they're in this thing together. The U.S. has made it absolutely clear that after they, quote, finish off Russia, China is the next in line. So there's a natural alliance here, the fault mostly of the U.S. and its benighted policies toward each country.
All right. Let's look at, since Ray McGovern there, Glenn Deason, has mentioned Russia, let's put that into the context. Let's have you put it into context for us. When the U.S. Talks about how China is going to take on the world order, it's shifting towards China, or that it's actually threatening the world order, which is a U.S. Dominated world order. But now that's changing, and the U.S. says China is the reason for it. But we can't talk about that unless we also bring in Russia into the picture. Isn't that correct? I mean, one example I'm guessing would be, for example, the BRICS group of countries, where you have China and Russia as part of that. And then there's a whole host of things that entail that, from trade to moving away from the dollar to other things that obviously exclude the U.S. Is that what is bothering, or one reason why the U.S. is bothered by this world order that it's losing its grip on?
Yes, but it's often portrayed incorrectly, because it's not a system where U.S. dominance is replaced with Chinese dominance, because the Chinese doesn't actually have any format for unipolarity. I mean, the United States will probably be the world's last unipolar country, because after the United States, the most you can hope for is a bipolar or multipolar system. So, and again, this has been part of the problem. When the West toppled the government in Ukraine and replaced the Russian-friendly government with this anti-Russian government in 2014, this was around the time when the Chinese had started to put out their China industrial policy, the China 2025, the Belt and Road Initiative, and began to develop all these new financial instruments. Now, this was quite dramatic for Russia because Russia had effectively a very Western-centric foreign policy. It had dreamt about this greater Europe all the way since the days of Gorbachev. But again, when NATO began to expand, they began to lose some faith. But still, many were hoping that they could gradually be integrated with the West and create some common, inclusive European security architecture. But, the toppling of the government in Ukraine really put that killed that off. And what happened since is a tectonic shift. It's Russia embracing now this what is called the Greater Eurasian Partnership, in which it seeks a closer and integrated economy with countries in the East. So China, Iran, India, Pakistan, South Korea, like all of them in the East. And this is quite interesting because China and Russia will obviously not dominate the international economy. It's not powerful in any ways, but it has a good contribution in terms of supporting China's ambition to create a new parallel international architecture. And you now see this because they're developing, parallel technological hubs, new industries decoupled from the American ones, new transportation corridors, sure. New financial architecture with all their banks and payment systems. And this is quite important in many ways. Of course, even if you look in the area of energy, it's quite extraordinary because Russia is a huge energy exporter. China's the main importer, and now they don't want to trade even in dollars anymore. And you see this spearheading a wider global trend, which you see, for example, even Saudi Arabia perhaps now switching away from dollar for its trade. So these two countries together are kind of spearheading a global trend, which you see with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. Uh-huh. So this is a big problem for Washington if they want to maintain hegemony.
Sure. Well, isn't that part of the world order then? As our guest there mentioned, Ray McGovern, you have Saudi Arabia that announced months ago, of course, at this point, that it is looking at using the yuan in terms of its oil transactions with China. You had actually Israel, a close U.S. ally, that changed a portion of its reserves from dollars to the yuan. And we're seeing these gravitational shifts towards China. And since I mentioned Israel, I do have to mention how a few years back now at this point, but the U.S. issued a harsh warning to Israel and said, don't let the Chinese run Haifa port. And Israel didn't even let the U.S. actually review or look at Haifa port to see the influence that China has there. Also taking a look at the EU. The EU does not want to let go of China in terms of its trading partner, and there's a diversion there. Is that part of the world order that the U.S. is losing its grasp on?
Well, it is. The currency factor is big. There was also a danger that the U.S. dollar would decline in this sense, but now it's sort of on steroids with all these countries, some of which you mentioned, switching into local currency and doing bargaining with Russia. What I'd like to emphasize is the bilateral relationship. Let's take annual trade, for example. Now, my first portfolio at CIA was Sino-Soviet relations. They hated each other. China was claiming large portions of Siberia. They were fighting across the riverine border, and the annual trade was $100 to $200 million a year. What's it going to be next year? $200 billion. Now, my mathematician son tells me, Dad, that's 1,000 times. 1,000 times means a lot. And, of course, they're natural traders, Russia being very rich in natural resources, and China needing those natural resources. So not only are they under threat from what they perceive as a common enemy, but they're naturally adaptable to satisfying the needs and furthering the trade and the wealth of each country or both countries together.
The fact that the U.S. has a military or militaristic approach towards China is not obviously something that's new there, Glenn Diesel. And I'd like to find out from you, how far do you think the U.S. is going to go when it comes to convincing countries in that part of the world that you know, China is a threat? We know that those countries, many of them are part of these large blocks, trade blocks, that the U.S. is not part of, such as the RCEP, for example. The U.S. is trying to, through the last ASEAN meeting that just occurred, trying to sway these countries into its own sphere. But those ASEAN countries don't want to be in this type of middle ground here. I mean, they want to maintain a middle ground. They don't want to be swayed into U.S. sphere through whatever incentives that the U.S. may be giving it, because after all, they do lots of trade with China. Do you think the U.S. is going to be successful in doing that?
No, not really. And this is quite a different area than from Europe, because in Europe, we already kind of outsourced a lot of our security to the United States. So for this reason, they do have a huge sway here. But in Asia, you don't see this aspect. You don't see this willingness to join an anti-China bloc. So far, the strongest bloc the United States has been trying to build is the Quad, which is the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. But again, the Indians are not really 100% on board with this. And actually, one of the key consequences of this war in Ukraine is Russia's shifting a lot of its oil exports and gas to the east. So India now is a huge consumer of Russian oil. So for this reason, India's actually being pulled closer into a partnership with Russia. So this makes them less likely to want to join any US-led alliance, as this will not only alienate China, but also Russia. So this idea of developing NATO of Asia, I don't think it's going to happen. And simply put, it's not. They don't have an option between two opposing alliances, because it's only the United States that are trying to drag them into an alliance. If you look at the Chinese systems they're trying to build, from the Shanghai Cooperation to BRICS, they're not actually alliances, because alliances are usually country A and B cooperating against country C. But they're not trying to mobilize any countries against the United States. Instead, you see them pulling in actually adversarial countries like, India, Pakistan, now Iran, maybe Saudi Arabia. Like, they want to bring all of this together, because this is a system where you seek security with other members instead of the members seeking security against a non-member. So it's not actually an alliance system, which is why the Chinese are even a bit reluctant to call the partnership with Russia an alliance, because that indicates it's aimed against someone. Instead, they say it's more than an alliance, because, again, it's not dependent